If you thought that last week's story was difficult, this week's story is even worse. Okay? So let's take that into consideration. Now, I do.
Can you unlock a little bit?
Sure. Okay. I do want to mention, before we go into our story, that there is actually a story in Sophocles that is similar, that has similarities to our story. Now remember, Sophocles lived in 442 BCE. King David is 500 years before that. Okay, so that you should understand what the time period is. So Sophocles writes a story about Sophocles.
So who is he?
Sophocles is one of the important philosophers, you know, Plato, Aristotle, you know, from that genre of writers. And he has a play where he talks about the Thebes War. And essentially there are two brothers fighting on opposite sides of the war, and he had basically one of the brothers get killed in war, and the king says they may not be buried. Antigone, which you might remember from high school, right? Antigone comes along and decides that she's going to sneak in at night and bury the dead brother. Okay? And then they catch her, and so the question becomes what to do with her. So in other words, in the play Antigone, there's a conflict between the laws of mankind, human beings need to be buried, and against the king's law, which was do not bury the dead. And those are the two questions, basically, that he deals with. Now, in our chapter, you're going to see we have something similar. Let's read the chapter through first, and then we'll go back and try to discuss as much as we can. Now, let me just mention to you, first of all, it's a mistake. It's not Shmuel Bet Chaf Gimel on the source sheet. It's Shmuel Bet Chaf Aleph. That's a typo. The last section of Shmuel, there are four chapters from Chaf to Chaf Dalid, consisting of six stories that do not belong at the end. They are an addend to the book, but that is not where they belong. So one of the things we're going to try to discuss today is when indeed did this story happen. But this is the first of those added on stories. And it says, Yehi vayhi ra'av b'mei David, shalosh shanim, shana acharei shana. There was a famine in the time of David, year after year. Vayivakesh David p'nei Hashem. And so David goes out to seek God to find out what is the reason for that famine.
But the same ra'av that he was as one of the three choices.
No, so that's, it seems to be not. That's correct. It seems to be not. It seems to be a different famine, but perhaps it isn't. We're not quite sure. Vayom Hashem El Shaul. And Hashem says to Shaul, Hashem says, here's the answer. El Shaul, because of Shaul, the El Beit Hadamim, and the house of blood, Al Asher Heimit et HaGivonim, because he put the Givonim to death. Vayikra Melech LaGivonim. So David calls to these Givonim, Vayomer Lehem, and he says to him, and here's a commentary from the text. Vagivonim lo mibnei Yisrael hema. Know that we're talking about a group that are not Jewish. Ki im miyeta ha'amori ubnei Yisrael nishbu ulehem. They will fund the seven nations. They're one of the Amori nations. And bnei Yisrael had made a promise to them. Vayivak Shaul lahakotam. And Shaul desired to smite them. Bekanoto livnei Yisrael v'Yehuda. When he was trying to... revenge is not the quite word to maintain the dignity of Bnei Israel and Yehuda. Vayomer David el Givonim. So David says to the Givonim, Me esel lechem. What can I do for you? Ubama echaper. And how can we make this good? Ubechu et nachalat Hashem. So God will give us the rain. Vayomer lo haGivonim. And the Givonim say, Ein lanu kesef v'zahav im Shaul v'im Beito. From Shaul and his house, we don't want any money. Ve'ein lanu ish lahamit b'Yisrael. And from the regular Jewish nation, we don't want to put anybody to death. Vayomer me'ata omrim aseh lachem. So David says to them, so what do you want? And I will do it. Vayomu el hamelech, ha'ish asher kilinu v'asher dimelanu, nishmadnu mi'yatzev b'chol gvul Yisrael. We only expect, you know, payment back from the man who harmed us and who prevented us from even being able to show our face anywhere in the boundaries of Yisrael. Yutan lanu shiva anashim ibanav, give us seven of his children, v'hoka'anum l'Hashem b'givat Sha'ul, and we're going to hang them in Givat Sha'ul b'chir Hashem. Aniatain. And the king says, I will do it. Vayachmol ha'melech al Mephibosheth ben Yehonatan ben Sha'ul, and the king has mercy specifically on Mephibosheth, who is the son of Yonatan, the grandson of Sha'ul, al shvuat Hashem asher beinotam ben David uben Yonatan ben Sha'ul, because David had sworn to Yehonatan that they would be, you know, take care of each other for life and for death. Vayikach ha'melech et shnei b'nei Ritzba bat Aya. So the king takes the two children of Ritzba bat Aya, asher yoldal l'Sha'ul, who were Sha'ul's, you know, children. She was a pilegesh to Sha'ul, et Armoni ve'et Mephibosheth. Apparently Mephibosheth was a common name at that point in time. Vet chameshet b'nei Michal, and the five children of Michal, bat Sha'ul, the daughter of Sha'ul, asher yoldal la'Adriel ben Barzilai ha'mecholati. Vayitneim biyat ha-givonim, and he gives them over to the givonim. Vayyokium bahar lifnei Hashem, vayiflu shivatam biyachad. And he gives them over to the givonim, and they kill all seven of them. Vehema humatu bimek tzir varishonim b'tchilat ketzir ha-se'orim. And they are killed at the beginning of the ketzir ha-se'orim, which is Pesach, right? The beginning of the Omer. Vatikach Ritzba bat Aya, so the mother of one of the two of them takes etafsak, she takes some sort of sack, vatitaehu la el hatsur, and she builds herself like a tent, mitachat ketzir ad nitach mayim alehem, and she stays out there until the rain comes, min hashamayim, from the heaven, velo nana of hashamayim lanuach alehem yomam, and she doesn't let the birds of prey come it during the day, ve'et chayat hasadeh laila, and the animals at night. Vayugad leDavid et asher asita Ritzba bat Aya pilegesh Sha'ul, and the message comes back to David what Ritzba is doing. Vayolech David vayikach et atzmot Sha'ul v'et atzmot Yonatan beno me'et ba'ale yavesh Gilad asher ganvu otam me'rechov Beit Shan. When Yonatan and Sha'ul were killed by the Plishtim hung their bodies as a display, as lest we killed the king. The people of Yavesh Gilad snuck in at night, stole the bodies, and buried them in Yavesh Gilad. Yavesh Gilad is Me'ever LeYarden. Okay, it's one of those places, Me'ever LeYarden. And so that is where Sha'ul and Yonatan are buried. Asher tulu'am sham ha'plishtim b'yom ha'kol plishtim et Sha'ul bel Gilboa. So David goes to Yavesh Gilad, he takes out their bodies, and he adds the seven children, okay, and he buries them in the family plot. Vayasu kol asher tziva ha-melech, and the people do what the king commands. Vayetar Elokim la'aretz acharei chein, and God then saves the people. There are a tremendous amount of questions that we have to ask about this chapter. If you start thinking about them, they start becoming this list of why is there a famine? Why is it the whole year? Why is it 3 years? If it's something that Sha'ul did, why are they getting punished for it now? Why does he wait 3 years to ask God? Why would Sha'ul, if there was a promise against the Givonim, what did Sha'ul do to them? And why would Sha'ul do that? How could David accept this demand that the Givonim asked him? How can he save Mephibosheth? How can he allow the bodies to hang for this amount of time? Michal, it says that there are five children of Michal. Michal doesn't have any children. We're going to do that next week, by the way. Okay, so you see there are a whole bunch of issues here that need to be understood. Now, the first thing we need to say is this is a chapter that cannot be understood without Torah Shabbat. There are just too many questions. There are just too many things that we don't understand, and we really have to turn to Torah Shabbat Peh to understand it. Now you'll see that on page 2 you have the Gemara in Yevamot. The Gemara in Yevamot explains our story. You have it both in Hebrew and English. We will go with the English, and I should have numbered it better. So let's try to keep it clear where we're up to. So the first thing that we're going to start with is this famine. Now, at the first, well, usually also, why is it only after 3 years that there's a famine? So first of all, on the pshat level, you could just say, the first year you say, yeah, it happens. The second year you say, ah, it's only after 3 years that you realize it's not a coincidence. This is a concept we have in halacha, right? You only say after something is 3 times that it becomes a chazakah. However, the Gemara tells us something different. The Gemara tells us, if you start in where it says C, there was a famine for 3 straight years in the days of David. The first year he suspected that it was due to idolatry amidst Yisrael, and he will serve foreign gods and there will be no rain. That's something we know from the other Nevi'im. So the whole year he checked and he did not find idolatry. Right, that was his initial response. No rain, must be Avodah Zarah. He goes ahead and he checks, and wow, no Avodah Zarah. That takes a year. But the famine continues. Comes the second year, he suspected that it was due to immorality. Sexual immorality, and again he finds a pasuk that says that. He checked and he did not find. So the third year he suspected that it was due to the people who publicly pledge tzedakah and do not give it. People who aren't doing chesed. Again, he finds a pasuk that proves that if there's no chesed, there's no rain. He checked and he did not find. So then he concluded that it had to do something with him perhaps, and that's when he turns to God. Okay, we're familiar with this idea that first man has to do his own effort, and only then does he turn to God. So then it says in the Pasuk that it says, Vayivakesh David et Pnei Hashem. And David sought out Hashem's countenance. And then the question asks, well, how does he do that? So in answer 5, Reish Lakish says that he sought it through the Urim V'Tumim. Okay, and it says, how does he learn that? You could also say, if you didn't want to say that he used the Urim V'Tumim, you could also say that he prayed, or it can obviously be a combination of those two answers. Now, the answer that God gives him, now look at the pasuk that God gives him, the answer. The answer comes in pasuk Aleph, Vayom Hashem El Sha'ul. Vayom Hashem El Sha'ul Ve'el Beit HaDamim Alasher Hemit et Hagiv Onim. How many answers is God giving David here? Three. Okay, what are the three? Whose fault is it?
Saul's.
What sin?
Bloody house.
Whose blood? Givonim. Okay, so that would be the way of reading it according to the Pshat. He asks three questions. Whose fault is it? Shaul's. What's the sin? Beit Damim. Whose blood? The Givonim. Okay, and so then if you continue looking in the Gemara actually continues and says that it's actually two sins here. When it says whose fault was it, it says Shaul. But if you look at 6i, in the Gemara 6i, the Gemara says it is due to Shaul that he was not eulogized properly. Because his body was stolen at night and hidden in Yavesh Gilad, he never received the funeral appropriate to a melech b'Yisrael. So now what we're seeing is based on Gemara, and the question, we have actually two sins. One sin that was to Shaul himself, and one sin that Shaul himself did that went to that he killed the Givonim. Now, we do not find ever in the Mikra that Shaul killed the Givonim. So what is this referring to? So here in the Gemara in Bavli, we have it in 7 and 8, we do not find that Shaul killed the Givonim. And the answer, number 8, the Gemara says, since he killed the Kohanim of Nov, when David runs away and Achitophel is there and he kills up all the Kohanim and Nov, who used to supply food and water to the Givonim, the verse considers it as if he killed them. So according to the Talmud Bavli, Shaul did not even kill any Givonim. He just harmed their livelihood. And by harming their livelihood, it's as if now that he killed them, because food and water become difficult for them to come by. The Yerushalmi on the same Gemara has a different Masorah. The Yerushalmi here says that in actuality, he did, when he killed the Kohanim, there happened to have been seven Givonim who were in the wrong place at the wrong time, and these seven Givonim got killed as well. And the Gemara even knows to tell us, two of them were woodcutters, two of them were water drawers, a shamish, a chazan, and a sofer. That's the Gemara in the Yerushalmi. So both the Bavli and the Yerushalmi associate it with the time that Shaul killed the Kohanim in Nov, but the Bavli says nobody was actually killed, and the Yerushalmi actually says that seven of them were killed.
The Yerushalmi also makes them into Jews.
The Yerushalmi sort of made, when it calls them a shamash, you don't have it. It's not online. that's how it works. When it talks about them being a shamish, a chazan, and a sofer, it makes them sound like they're very, very much part of the community. Now, does that fit with the pshat? Why not? Why doesn't it fit with the pshat? These stories that he killed them by accident when he killed the... First of all, it's called the House of Blood. First of all,
there doesn't seem to be any blood if he killed them.
Right, so if he didn't kill them, then what's the blood? Correct, that's one. What else in the Pasuk would seem to indicate to us that it's got to be something else? Look at the Givonim say.
They plotted, they consumed and plotted.
And if you look in verse 5, right, the man who consumed us and plotted against us that we had destroyed remaining with any Israel's borders. The Givonim make it sound as if it was an actual war. He is going out to fend off. And in addition, it says back in the Pasuk, when it says in Pasuk 2, when it says that he killed them, he says he killed them bikanoto livnei Yisrael, in his zeal for the sake of the children of Israel. It doesn't make it sound like it was a mistake, the way the Gemara reads it. So there are another number of commentators who follow the pshat, and those commentators who follow pshat, for instance, the Radak says that Shaul decided, and we'll talk about this in a moment, that the promise that the Jews had made during the time of Yehoshua was not a valid promise. Now, Shaul had this idea about promises, and that if you break a promise, what happens to you? When his own son doesn't follow the promise of not eating anything during the war, what did Shaul want to do to him? Kill him. So Shaul has this attitude of, well, if you break a promise, if promise isn't done properly, you have to die. So he decides that these Givonim need to die. Abarbanel rejects this. Abarbanel rejects this because he says, the promise was made 400 years ago. You don't go after people from a bad promise from 400 years. So the only other idea that we have, if you look in source number 4, source number 4, actually 3 and 4. Let's start with 3. In 3, it says, Ushmol meit, v'yispadu lo kol Yisrael v'ekru b'ramah b'yirov v'shol heisir avot v'et ha'yudaim min ha'aret. Shaul had taken it upon himself to remove from the land all of the witches and witchcraftery. And actually, we're going to study this chapter 2 a little bit further on in the semester. And if we skip down to verse 9, Vatomer ha'isha elav, and this witch, the witch of Endor, says to Shaul, Hine ata yadati et asher asa Shaul asher hechrit et ha'avot ve'yuda. Yid oni min ha'aris. Remember, she's speaking to Shaul, but she's pretending she doesn't know it's Shaul. And she says to him, well, Shaul got rid of all of the witches. That's source number 3. So it could be that when he was busy, getting rid of foreign negative influences, he decided that it wasn't only time to get rid of the witches at that point in time, he could get rid of these Giv'onim as well. But as you see, there is no outright reference to Kilim Giv'onim. Another idea that you find, because you see that the Mefarshim are looking for some sort of hint about when he could have possibly killed them, in source number 4, which is already in Sefer Melachim, Vayelech HaMelech Giv'ona Lizboach Sham Ki Hayah Bamah Gadola Elef Alot Yalesh Lamo Al Mizbeach Ahu. A large Mizbeach was established in Giv'on. In order to establish a large bama in Giv'on, you might have had to move some of the population. Okay? And when you move population, we know from our experience, it is never a good thing for them. So that is another opinion that perhaps that they had to be moved away from their cities, and that caused them to die. So anyway, you see that the Mefarshim are looking for some sort of explanation about how it is that Shaul harmed these Giv'onim, and if we sort of try to sum up the ideas, either he hurt their Parnassa, or he forced them to move, which is also hurting their Parnassa, or he actually killed them. In any of these, what is his motivation for doing it? So according to the Gemara, it seems to be almost that it was a mistake. If you follow the other opinions, it's sort of a, I don't want to use the term, but perhaps an ethnic cleansing. And that's this kin'ah for Bnei Yisrael. He's wanting to get rid of this negative foreign influence. Okay? So in any way, however you want to do this now, he decides that David, remember, God has told David there are two problems. Shaul has not gotten his proper burial, and the Giv'onim have been harmed. Now, David decides, first of all, to deal with which problem first?
Sure.
No. He decides to deal with the Giv'onim first. Why does he decide to deal with the Giv'onim first? Now, how much time has passed since Shaul has been killed? It's minimum a year, maximum 3 years. We find in the Mefarshim a whole bunch of different opinions. But either way, Shaul's already dead and buried. So therefore, King David says, he's waited this long, you know, it'll wait another, whatever, month or two, and he's going to leave it. Now let's talk a little bit about who were these Giv'onim. So to understand who these Giv'onim are, we have to look in source number 5. Source number 5 is the Perek in Yehoshua, and it tells us like this: Yoshvei Giv'on shamu et asher asa Yehoshua liYericho v'Ai. The guys sitting in Giv'on heard about how Bnei Yisrael have captured Yericho and Ai. Vayatsu gam hema be'arma. So they decide to make a trick. Vayechu vayitztayaru vayikhu sakim balim lechamrehem v'naodot yayin balim umevukaim umitzurim. So they dress up and they wear old clothing and they take canteens. They came from really far away. V'neulot balot, and they take shoes that are all worn out. Umutalot b'ragleihem v'simlot balot aleihem v'chol lechem tzedem yavesh hayan nukdim. And you know, they bring food that has, you know, all dried out, and I don't know whether it's got mold on it already, you know. They want to make it look like they've been walking for eons. Vayahu el Yoshua el Machaneh Gilgal, and they come to Yoshua in the Gilgal. Vayomu alav el Ish Yisrael, and they say to Yoshua and all people, Me Eretz Rechoka Banu, wow, did we come from far away? Va'ata kirtu lanu brit, and we want you to make a brit with us. Vayomi Ish Yisrael el achivi ulai bekir bi ata yoshev. They say, wait a minute, maybe, you know, you really are. Vachos l'chabris, can we make a treaty with you? Vayomi Yoshua abdecha anachnu. And they say to Yoshua, no, we are your servants. Vayomi leim Yoshua, mi atem umeayin tavou. Who are you and where are you coming from? Vayomi lev meretz mechokam odbo. We come from so far away. Avdecha l'shem Hashem Elokecha, ki shamanu shamu et kol asher asab Mitzrayim. We came from so far away because we heard about all the great things that God did for you and what He took you out of Mitzrayim. V'kol asher asal shnei al nachei amoi. And what you did to Og and to Sichon, asher be'eva hayadein, l'sichon melech hachbon, v'l'og melech habashan, asher ba'ashtarot. Vayomu elenu ziknenu v'chol yoshvei atzenu. We had a meeting, and the elders and the other people of our land said to us, kechu b'yadchem tzeda l'derech, take yourselves food, v'lechu likratam, and go on a journey to greet them, v'amartem aleihem, and you should say to them, avdechem anachnu, we are your servants, v'ata kirtu lanu brit, and make this brit with them. Zelachmenu, look at our bread. Chan hitztayadnu oto. We left the house, it was hot. Mibatenu biyom teitenu lechet elchem. Vatahine yavesh vahayanu kudim. And now look, it's all old and moldy. Ve'elu nodot hayayin. And look at our things that carry the wine, the flask. Hashem ilenu chadashim. They were new, brand new when we left the house. And they, but now look at them. They like you can't even use them anymore. They're all worn out. The elu samlotenu. Look at our clothing. V'na'aleinu and our shoes. Balu merov haderech. They're so worn out because we've been walking so far. V'ikru et anshim v'tzedam v'tpi Hashem lo sha'alu. And the Jews do not ask God. V'yaslam Yeshua shalom, and Yeshua makes with them peace. V'yichros lahem brit l'chayotam. And they make a promise that they're going to keep them alive. Not only Yoshua, but the leaders of the nation make this promise. And this at the end of 3 days. That they make the brit. The Jews discovered that they've been fooled. And that they're not from such a faraway land, but they're really neighbors. They live close to them. Vayasu b'nei Yisrael, so b'nei Yisrael make the journey. Vayavo el areihem b'yom ha'shlishin. It takes them only 3 days to get to the city. V'areihem giv'on u'kfira u'be'erot v'kiryat ye'arim. Those are the cities that these guys are living in. V'lo hukam b'nei Yisrael. And b'nei Yisrael do not attack them. Ki nishbu'u lehem se'ei hada b'hashem. Because the nisi'im swore a promise in the name of God. Vayalunu kol ha'eda al hanisiim, and the people complain. They disagree with the decision made by the nisiim. Vayomu kol hanisiim al kol ha'eda, and the leaders of the people say to the nation, Anachnu nishbanu lahem b'Hashem Elohei Yisrael. When you make a promise in the name of God, ata lo nuchal lingoa bahem. We cannot change it. Zos na'aseh lahem. This is what we're going to do. Hachaya otam, we'll let them live. V'lo yeh aleinu ketzef al ha'shavua asher nishpa'u lahem. And God will not be angry at us if we break the promise. Keep the promise, God's happy. Break the promise, God gets angry. It says it very clearly there. V'yomu aleihem ha'nisiyim. So the nisiyim tell the people, yichyu, they will live. V'yu chotvei etzim, they will be wood choppers. V'shoavei mayim, and water drawers. Remember, that's what the Gemara in Yerushalmi said. V'chol ha'edah she'dibru lahem ha'nisiyim. And they basically, the nisiyim tell the people that this is the way it has to be because the promise was made in God's name. So you could even say that technically it should not be a valid treaty because their side was incorrect. But the nisiyim are saying it doesn't matter what their side did because we made the treaty in God's name, therefore we cannot change it. So that's the background of the story. So these givonim who've been living amongst the Jews who made peace under false pretenses in 400 years, somehow Shaul has harmed them. So in verse 3, David says to the givonim, me'e'eselechem, what should I do for you and how can I make atonement? Now when King David says to them, how can I make atonement? What essentially is he offering them?
Money.
He's offering them money. Correct. In biblical terms, when on Erev Yom Kippur, we do kaparot with money, chicken, whatever, something other than the human being. And here too, he's offering them money. And we see this in the Gemara. We're up to, it's 10a. Actually, it's 10.1. What can I do for you to atone? And then the Givonim say, listen to the answer the Givonim say, Ein lanu kesef zahav im sha'ul. What are they, what's the answer to that question they're saying? We don't want money from the house of Shaul. We don't want money from Shaul. The Ein nu ish lahamit bi Yisrael. And we don't want to kill any Jews. Which means, if you understand, if you put the two sentences together, money from the house of Shaul we don't want. Putting to death another Jew we don't want. Means what do we want? We want to put to death somebody from the house of Shaul. Okay, so you understand from their answer, that is what they are indeed saying.
But wait, it says we don't want to put to death any man in Israel. Surely Shaul's house.
Right, right. But they are separating, by having that first sentence first, they are separating out the house of Shaul. They're saying, in other words, no other Jew will satisfy us. Now, the Gemara gives us a very famous quotation that I'm sure you know of. You have it, it's like 9:4. Actually, let's go back to 3. David tries appeasing them, and they refused. 4. David says, there are 3 simanim of Yisrael. Jews are merciful. They have a sense of shame. Gemara says, by shanim, and they bestow chesed, gomle chasadim. And the Gemara continues to prove it. How do you know that they are merciful by Shanim and Chasadim? And then if you look at 5, the Gemara says, whoever has these 3 simanim is fitting to cling to Yisrael. And then you are familiar with the idea that if you meet somebody who does not have one of the question there, Judaism. Okay, you should question whether they're actually a Jew. And this explains to you why if it said in Pasuk 2, why all of a sudden it says, V'hagivonim lo mibnei Yisrael hema. Why do you need that sentence? Because only a Jew would never ask for something like this in exchange. Only somebody who does not have these character traits would ask for this. So that, yeah. The government actually appears in a number of different places, not just here. Okay, and it's sort of like a side comment. Anyway, so our story continues that David says to the Givonim, what can I do? And he tries to convince them to take money, and they say, we don't want money. And so what does David say? They say that they want to take 7 of Shaul's children. Now, why 7? According to the Rishalmi, 7 is very easy for us because they killed 7. 7 is, that's one explanation. But according to the Peshat, we said, according to Peshat, it sounds to us that indeed Shaul actually killed out more than just these 7. So why would they come up with 7? So here it's probably a play on language. Shaul breaks the Shivuah. Shivuah is the promise. So therefore, they symbolically want 7. Okay? That, or you could say possibly that that's how many children were left. You know, we don't really know what the idea is, but they specifically say they want these 7 because they only have a bone to pick with him. And notice, Pasuk, first of all, you'll notice that they don't even use his name. See how they talk to him in verse Hey, Vayomolim el Ha'ish Asher Kilinu. Why don't they call him Shaul? See, that's in verse 5. The man who consumed us. Why don't they use his name? I think it shows that they have such hatred. You know, they don't even want to use his name for him. He's the one that we want to take revenge to, and this idea of the Asher Nishmadnu Mihi Yetzev Lefnei Gvul Yisrael, he prevented us from standing in the boundaries. What does that mean? I think what that means is that also syndicated coin shots is that they weren't able to go out safely in the street. That till a point in time, it was known that you cannot persecute the Givonim, because if you persecute because of the promise, and they are protected citizens. Who? They're part of the 7 Amim. They were a nation of the 7
Amorim.
Amori, who was supposed to live within Eretz Yisrael, who Bnei Yisrael was supposed to wipe out. Correct. So there was a time where they were a protected piece of the population. Once Shaul sort of starts harming them, being moving them around, being killing them by ear and nose, whatever, they lose that status of protection, and therefore people feel that they can abuse them whatever way it is, and that's what they're referring to in verse 5. And Yutnam Lanush, we should give us 7. Now they say, who you should give us? Notice that. They say how they're going to be killed and where they're going to be killed. He says, Geravonim are taking ownership over this. Why do they want to specifically kill him and give at Shaul? It's a symbol, right? It's completely in their face. And then, who's calling Shaul Bechir Hashem? Certainly not the Givonim in verse 6. So according to the Gemara, that's actually a bat kol comes out and says, Shaul is still Bechir Hashem. But anyway, the Melech says, Ani Etein. Now, if you look in modern biblical commentators, they all will tell you, sure, David gave over. Why did David give over the children? Because he's looking for a way to get rid of all the previous king. You know this. We have this in the Mikra a number of times. You want to become king. You rebel. So what do? You get rid of all of anybody who would be a threat to you. The problem with, and this is what's Mikubal, by the way, in biblical critics, they say David is guilty here because David was obviously trying to get rid of his enemies. He could have found another way out. The problem with this answer is that, first of all, the Mikra, and that's an important point. When David sins, with the story of Bathsheba, the Mikra says, and this was very evil in the eyes of God. There is no indication here that God is unhappy with David, first of all. Secondly, just technically, the 7 children who are killed, 2 of them are Ritzbahs, 5 of them are Michal Meiraz, we'll talk about that in a minute, but none of those 7 could have become king. The sons of Pilshim do not become kings. The only one who technically had the right to become king was Mephibosheth. And he is the one that King David leaves alive. So there you have, that's just, you know, your problem with biblical criticism. Anyway, let's talk about that for a minute, why he's willing to leave Mephibosheth alive. Let's talk about that first. Michal is not a Pilegish. Michal is actually King David's wife. These children, but it says in the Pasuk, and we're going to talk about her next week, Michal does not have children. So here it says that there are 5 children born to Michal. Who was born to Adriel?
That's Merav.
That's Merav. Merav dies. Michal raises her sister's children. And we know in the biblical places that you raise a child, even if you have not given birth to the child, it's as if you have given birth to the child. So that's right. So 2 of these children were born to Ritzbah, who was a Pelegesh, so they could not have been king. These other 5 were born to Adriel, Hamacholati. So they don't even have the kingship doesn't go through the daughter. Okay? So they too don't have a chance to become king, but that goes back to that. Anyway, so those are the 5 children. But let's talk about Mephibosheth. Now, many of you know, unfortunately, we've read those tshuvot from the Holocaust, where they took, you know, X number of children, and there were people who had money to redeem their child. And they asked the halakhic shaila, if I redeem my child, it means that they're going to take another. Am I allowed halakhically to redeem my child? And the answer was,
yes.
No. The answer was no. Because it's if you're doing your child and he was safe, it's one thing. But you know that they're just going to take somebody else instead, so therefore you can't. So the same question here comes about Mephibosheth. If they ask for 7, how is it possible for David to pull him out from the 7? Except, the flip side of this is that David has a promise that he made to Yonatan. And you have this in verse number 10, in source number 10. In source number 10, David and Yonatan are making the shvuah. V'lo tachrit et chastacha me'im beiti ad olam. It wasn't a promise that was made just while we're living. It is a promise that we're making forever. V'lo bihikaret Hashem et oivei David me'ish ish me'al pnei adama. ויכרות יונתן עם בית דוד וביקש השם מיד אויבי דוד ויוסף יונתן להשביע את דוד באהבתו אותו כי יבת נפשו אהבו. And it says it doesn't matter, and when he made the covenant, and even when, you know, your enemies are destroyed and you're the king, this promise will still be in effect. So you have David's promise on one hand, you have the agreement that he made with the Givonim on the other hand, and there is a possible contradiction here as well. So let's look in the Gemara. The Gemara continues with this question. The Gemara went up to 5b. The question is, and the king took Armon and Mephibosheth and the five sons of Michal. Why did he take these? So according to Rav Huna, he passed them in front of the Aron, and whoever the Aron absorbed would be killed, and whomever the Aron expelled would live. We have this in a number of places where the Aron plays a part in the decision-making ceremony. The one that comes to mind immediately is the story of Achan. After Achan sins, they pass all the Shvatim in front of the Aron, and the Aron says, it's this tribe, and then it's this family, and then it's Achan. So here too, it plays like an Urim V'Tumim, that's correct. And what it does here is also, in other words, according to this Gemara now, we're taking it out of the hands of David and we're putting it on God. That there's a godly involvement here, that it is God who is making the decision who is going to be given over to the Givonim. So then, Rabbi Chana Bar Katina says, the king had mercy on Mephibosheth ben Yehonatan, and says that, and so when he did not pass Mephibosheth in front of the Aron. So then there's an objection in the Gemara. Did he show favoritism? And as I pointed out, it's like killing somebody else. Answer two, rather he passed him in front of the Aron, and the Aron absorbed him. The Aron did pick Mephibosheth, and David requested mercy, and then the Aron expelled him. Still, this is favoritism. The Gemara says, rather he prayed that the Aron should not absorb him. Okay? So that is the way we get out of it, that you can do. Prayer is not making a decision yourself. Prayer is you say to God, God, please don't pick him, and whatever God decides, that is the answer that the Gemara closes with, that David just prayed for him, and Mephibosheth was saved. Nache, correct. Mephibosheth is a he has a problem with his legs. Okay, so now we come into this major issue of when King David gives over these children to the Givonim, he is essentially ignoring a number of biblical laws. What biblical laws are being ignored here? So first of all, if you look at source 11, source 11 is a pasuk in Devarim, where the pasuk in Devarim clearly tells us, lo yumutu avot al banim, velo yumutu al avot, banim lo yamut al avot, ish bechet o yumatu. The Torah tells us very clearly that you cannot put a child to death for a sin of the fathers. So that is problem number one. Problem number two is in 12. In source number 12 it says, V'chi yeh b'ish chet mishpat mavet, and if somebody for whatever reason gets put to death, v'talita oto al ha'etz, and he gets hung, lo talin nevelato al ha'etz. You are not allowed to leave that body hanging, ki kevar tikberenu bayomahu. That day, the body has to be buried. He killat elokim taloi velot tameat an matecha, Hashem el Hashem el kechan, because it's not even kavod to God to leave this body hanging because man is created in the image of God and therefore deserves the respect. So we have a conflict here between what we're reading in the verses and what King David does, and open outright biblical laws.
What about handing Jews over
as well? Okay, so let's go into the Gemara. Yeah, that's sort of even bigger than that. Let's see how the Gemara deals with this. Okay, so we're up to 5J. Okay, fathers will not die, or sons will not die. Answer Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba. It is better to uproot a letter of the Torah than to publicly desecrate Hashem's name. Okay, that is the answer, and then it continues. From the beginning of the harvest until the rain. By the way, we said the bodies, they were killed on Pesach, until the rain. When does rain come? No, after even. Okay, we are desperately waiting for Cheshvan. We're desperately waiting for the rain of Cheshvan when we start saying the same Talmud Matar, and so the bodies hung from Nisan until Cheshvan, which is a 7-month period. Answer again, the Gemara says, it is better to uproot a letter of the Torah in order to publicly sanctify Hashem's name. So what does it mean, uproot the letter from the Torah? So first of all, the Ritva says, the Pasuk says, if you go back to source 11, if you, what letter are we taking out? Now, of course, it doesn't mean literally letter, but the Ritva says, what letter are we taking out? You're taking out the Lamed. So it no longer says, Lo Yamut Avot Ubanim. Now, when does that, what does that mean? That in extraordinary circumstances, because we were talking about a Chilul Hashem, it is very, very difficult to counterbalance a Chilul Hashem, especially a Chilul Hashem that is made in public. Now, I think that it's a very simple answer we could say, is that we don't have to justify this behavior here, because in essence, who was making the decisions here? Or even the Givonim. This was their court, this was their decision, this was their punishment to give out. So therefore, if this is the way they behave, I don't have to justify it. That's one way of approaching the story. Therefore, it is a Jewish court. Now, the Radak here actually tries to say that the sons were actually involved in killing the Givonim as well. That's what he wants to say, but it really is highly unlikely because the children were probably young at that point in time. And so therefore, he makes a suggestion, which is the one you're suggesting, that this was a decision that was made in heavenly court. When it says the sons will not die for a father's sin, that's only in human court. That the laws that we have in human court are not the same laws that we have in heavenly court. And therefore, we might not be able to understand what the idea was. Now, if you look at source number 13, source number 13 actually tells us, the Rambam in Hilchot Melachim tells us, Kol harugim nefashot shelo b'riyah u'b'rura o b'lo hatra'ah afilu b'eid echad o sonei sharag b'shkaga. If you have somebody who commits a murder and we don't have two witnesses, or they didn't receive a warning, or they didn't have all of the requirements to be put to death, yesh lemelech rishut laharog oto. The king has special powers. Why do we give the king special powers? Because we all know that Beit Din didn't like to put people to death. Beit Din didn't like to put people to death, so therefore you might have a society where people feel that they can do it and get away with it. So although Beit Din might not be able to punish you, know that the king could. So therefore, the Taken Ha'olam Kefi Masha Sha'at Tzricha. We expect the king to have that ability to understand that it's, for instance, now the our Knesset is trying to change the law that arson should be terrorist attack, and you know, throw away the key. You have to have a law to in order to do that. So here too, that's the idea that the king has the authority to make that decision. He therefore could kill many on one day. He could also leave the body hanging. Why would a king want to leave the body hanging? That we should understand that, you know, the king has that authority and you need to see it. So we do understand that there are certain times where the halakha, although it says you may not leave the body hanging, that you could if the society at that point needed it. The Gemara, though, continues, and let's see what happens. The Gemara says like this. Again, we're up to 5M. It is better to uproot a letter from the Torah in order to publicly sanctify God's name. What is the public sanctification of God's name? The public sanctification of God's name is passerbys would ask about the people hanging, and they would learn that they were sons of kings who harmed converts. There is no nation as fit to cling to as Israel. If the sons of kings were punished thusly, all the more so were commoners. If for harming converts thusly, then for harming Israel more the same. Immediately, there were 150,000 new converts. And it says Shlomo had 70 workers carrying on the shoulder and 80,000 quarrying in the mountains. You have that in source number... I thought I brought it for you. In source...
2N.
In the Gemara, you're saying? No, I brought you the Pasuk from... I thought I brought you the Pasuk... Oh, here it is, yeah. It's 9. Source number 9 is the Pasuk in Melachim. The source of Melachim says, Vayhila Shlomo, Shivim Elef Nosei Sabal, Ushmonim Elef Chotzev Ba. He had 150,000 workers. Now, according to the Gemara we're just reading, who are these 150,000 workers? These 150,000 workers are converts. Where did they convert from? They see the bodies hanging. They say, what are those bodies hanging? The answer is, well, these are sons of kings who harmed questionable converts. You know, converts who tricked the Jews. And they would say, if this is what happens to sons of kings who harm questionable converts, how much more so must they go out of their way to protect real converts? And how much more so would they punish a regular person who harms converts?
Were they converts or ger toshav?
They were more like a ger toshav, correct. They were that sort of like quasi, that's what I say, a quasi convert. And even so, the Gemara goes out of its way, the Torah goes out of its way to protect these people. And to see it even stronger, you also have it in source number 6. In source number 6, it's the Midrash Rabbah, and the first thing it does is it brings those questions that I asked. Let's skip to 1, 2, 3, 4 lines from the bottom. The Hayu Yisrael Omrim Lehem. People would ask, what are these bodies hanging? Avotam Shel Elu Pashtu Yedehem Begerim Geruim. The father of these dead boys, his father harmed questionable Gerim. Amalahem v'chimativan amulahem elu hagerim shenitgeru bimei Yehoshua. These are the converts who converted during Yehoshua. Amulahem v'chi b'shvil hagerim hagururim ha'arurim ha'ela. And if for these cursed, questionable converts, asakadosh baruch hu la'amo kein, God would allow people to do that to his nation? Ma b'nei melachim kein. And not only do we do it for questionable gerim, but we do it to the sons of kings? Behejiaot al achat kama v'kama. For commoners, how even more so. Uman elu shalonit gairu l'shem shamayim. And these converts didn't convert. The givonim didn't convert because they had this tremendous love of God. They converted because they wanted to save their skins. But look how God goes out of his way to protect them. How much more so will God go out of his way to protect somebody who is a legitimate convert? V'day ein Eloha ke'elohehem. There is no God like your God. V'ein umah ke'mu'atam. And there is no nation like your nation. V'ein lanu lidabek ela b'umazu. And we want to become part of this nation. She'eloheha gadol mikel Elohim. Because their God is greater than all other gods. Miyad hitgayru harbe geirim umot ha'olam. And that story caused a tremendous amount of conversion, not that we're looking for them, Boto Sha'ak Kuf Nun Elef. 150,000 Jews join it at this time. Now, does that make the story easier for us to understand? No, not really. Let's be honest. But that is actually how the Gemara comes to that conclusion, that we had a terrible Chilul Hashem that was caused by Shaul, and the only way to counteract that Chilul Hashem is with this public Kiddush Hashem. Now, based on the reading and based on the Gemara, who taught these converts? The Mishnah just says She'amu Yisrael. But based on reading in the chapter, logic demands us to say that who was the one who was teaching the converts? Let's go back to the chapter. She leaves the body. The bodies are hung all the way from Cheshvan, from Nisan to Cheshvan. Verse 10. Vatikach ritzba bat aya etasak. One of the mothers, the Pilegesh of Shaul, takes a sackcloth and builds herself a tent, and she stays out there all season, 7 months, morning and night. I think logic demands us to say that when did people ask these questions? When they saw the bodies hanging. Who are they going to ask? The woman standing there. Okay, that's what makes sense to us, so that these 150,000 converts, my reading of the chapter, has to be associated primarily with her. Now, this is an amazing thing when you think about it for a minute. Here is a woman whose two innocent children have been killed, and yet she is able to not be bitter, but she is able to promote the justice here. And here we have a fascinating idea. If you look in verse 10, it says that she set up the tent al hatzur. What is a tzur? A tzur is a rock. But usually in biblical Hebrew, when we want to turn a rock, we use the term Evan. What is a tzur? So if you look at the last source on page 7, source number 15, Vatita'ehu la al hatzur. Amar Reb Oshiyahu, Shahaita Omeret Hatsur Tamim Po'alo Kichol Dorchav Mishpat. That what is a tzur? Not only is a tzur a rock, but you also know that tzur is another name of God. You know that from Hanukkah, Maos Tzur Yeshua Tzi. That we refer. So in Ha'azinu, there's a pasuk that says Hatsur Tamim Po'alo. That everything that God does is just. And so that here, this is where she's able to draw her strength from, and she is able, when it says that she sets up her tent on the rock, the Medrash says, why does it use that term? Because she's able to look at the tragedy that has happened to her, and she accepts it as being from God, and everything that God does is just. Now, what else do we know about this woman, first of all? What do we see about her from these verses? So first of all, we see her to be an extremely strong woman, physically. Okay, because if she's chasing away the animals at night and the birds during the day, when is she sleeping? And if she's living out in the tent, what is she eating? Where is she showering? I mean, this is through the summer. I mean, let's think about this like in a very, try to very practical type of way. Where is everybody else? You know, she seems to be doing this single-handedly. And it seems to be also that not only is she defending, obviously she's not just taking care of her two children, she's taking care of another five bodies, that she really does not have a responsibility for them. Now, how long does she stay out? This is an interesting thing in the Pasuk. It says that she stays out there ad nitach mayim. Now, the term nitach, which you have in verse 10, means that she stayed out until the rain came, which meant that rain did come. But the term nitach in the Bible is always rain of anger. It's not rain of bracha. Okay, so there is rain, and then she comes in. But then in the end of the parashah, in Pasuk Yudalid, it says that God saved the country. So we understand here that in actuality, there were two rains. When did the second rain come? Let's see what happens, right? So she is out there protecting. Let me just talk about her name for a minute before I go further. You think Ritzpah means floor. It doesn't, right? But in modern day Hebrew, Ritzpah means floor. But Ritzpah in biblical Hebrew and also has other meanings as well. And if you look in source number 8, source number 8 is a pasuk from Yeshayahu. Yeshayahu has that vision. Remember, it's probably his first vision. And he sees the malach. Vayaaf elai echad min hasarafim. One of the angels flew at me. Ubiyado Ritzpah. And in his hand he had a glowing coal. And then he touches Yeshayahu on the lip, but that's a different story. So Ritzpah does not have that meaning necessarily of floor, as we know from modern Hebrew, but it means burning coal. And I think that that's a very appropriate name for her, because for, in order for her to do what she's been doing, she really has to have that fire inside her to accomplish what she wants to accomplish. Now, just a side point, do you know what an ayah is? An ayah is in the same source, source 8, in the Pasuk in Vayikra. Vayikra gives us a list of animals that you are not, birds, that you are not allowed to eat. Kashrus for birds is not based on signs, it's based on misora. And the birds that you're not allowed to eat are the nesher, the paras, the aznia, the da'ah, and the ayah. Ayah is a non-kosher bird that, I don't know why she's called that, but that's her, I don't know whether that's her mother, her father, but that's who she's associated with. Anyway, let's go back to our story. Okay, so she does this tremendous amount of strength from her perspective. Perhaps I think it's also perhaps a silent protest when she goes out there, and she stays. And she is really, really being moser nefesh for these dead children. And again, I believe that who is it that's teaching this lesson to the converts? It has to be her. So then what happens in verse 11? Vayugad le David et asher asata ritzpa bat ayah pilegesh sha'ul. It gets back to King David. And as a result of what she does, what does David then go out and do? Then David goes out and decides to give King Shaul his proper burial. Although it had told us at the beginning of the chapter that one of the reasons that God was angry is because Shaul had not received a proper burial. So when does Shaul receive a proper burial? Only when Ritzpah goes out of her way for these dead children does King David say to himself, you know, I also, if this is what she's doing, and she's just, who is she? You know, okay, she's the mother, but she's a commoner. I, as the king, have to do what is right. So at that point in time, as a result of her actions, King David goes out, gets the bones from Yavesh Gilad of Shaul v'Yehonatan, travels throughout the whole country, gives them the proper respect that they deserve, brings them home finally with these other seven, and they all receive the proper burial. And it's only after they are all received the proper burial, only then, Vayatar Elohim La'aretz Acharei Chen. Only then does God give Gishmei Bracha. So that if we look at Rizpah, although she seems to be a side personality in our chapter, we see that she really is the one who brings about the salvation from the famine. It is because of her actions that King David does what is right. It is because of her actions that the children are protected, and the real reign only comes after Shaul is buried, which explains to us, by the way, remember we asked why is the famine in the time of David, why wasn't the famine in the time of Shaul? So here the famine is the time of David because they too are guilty of having not brought the proper respect to Shaul. Now, Rizpah, actually, remember we spoke about Antigone. Rizpah also is the one who was able to find the balance between the king's law was the bodies have to hang. Human law is that these bodies deserve a burial. She is able to, by staying, by giving of herself, she's able to maintain both laws because she's able to protect the dignity, which David is not protecting the dignity. Although he might have given over the children, this is where he should have put his foot down. And she's able to maintain their law as well. Now, we actually meet Rizpah again in the future. We meet Rizpah again here in source number 7. In source number 7, the story goes like this. We're trying to reunite. There was a division between the Malchut after Shaul. V'lishol pilegos ushma Rizpah bat Aya. V'yomel Avna madua bata el pilegesh avi. Avner, who is the Sar Tzava of Mephibosheth, he wants to marry the Pilegesh. Now, you know from other biblical stories, marrying a Pilegesh is a way of saying that I want to be king. Okay? Because only a king can marry the Pilegesh of a previous king. So when Avner says he wants to marry Rizpah, it's his way of saying that he wants to be king. Vayicha la'Avner ma'od al divrei Ishbosheth. And Avner gets very mad at how Ishbosheth spoke to him. Vayoma harosh kelev anochi. Like, do you talk to me? What am I, a dog? Asher Yehuda hayom esach chesed in beit Shaul avicha. I did a chesed with Shaul's house. And then after that, Avner actually goes to King David and makes peace with King David. Okay, so that we do see her coming up later again. The story is a difficult one. There's no way around it. Why does King David give over these children? I don't think we gave a satisfactory answer. Why doesn't he put down his foot and say, can't, sorry, that's not an option.
Passing the children before they arose doesn't reminiscent of like passing the child from all of them. It just bothers me, the whole concept.
Right, and you'll also notice that it's not, we get no reference to that in the Mikra at all.
Yeah,
that's completely, I think that what the Gemara is trying to do there is trying to move it out of and saying there wasn't God's involvement here. I think that's the message there. First of all, I think there's an important point here, and this is something we see in a number of different situations in the Mikra, is that, you know, there are sometimes, we do meet nations in the world, we do meet people in the world who are jerks. You know, and unfortunately, you sometimes have to deal with them according to their rules. That's just what happens. But let's try to sort of play it through. If King David had said to the Givonim, they had said, this is what we want, and King David would have said, can't have it, what would have happened then? What a possible... I think that could have had. Nobody ever asked them. They sort of, you know, stayed where they are. Once you're sort of putting them in position and you ask them what you want and they say, this is what we want, and then you say no, that might be enough of a rationale to actually begin some sort of civil war. because they are a foreign group within the idea.
So they deceived. I mean,
they are wrong. Correct.
I mean, originally they deceived.
Originally they deceived, and originally they were wrong. But it doesn't seem to matter just because they are wrong, and just because they're at this point in time. And I think perhaps, and even perhaps say that Ritzpah is also, we can even say that perhaps she is the one who is preventing a civil war. Because let's say, instead of saying, oh, Hatzor Tamim Pa'alo, let's say every time she came by, she would say, do you see what these Givonim did? Did you see what horrible people they are? Do you see what they caused? And that too could have fanned the flames of something that could have really gone on to be something that is. And the last point I want to make is, because I'm completely out of time, is when did the story happen? We didn't have a chance to talk about that. When did this story actually happen? Is there any sort of hint to us? There is only one other hint that this story happened, and that it probably happened before the Mered of Avshalom. If you remember, David is running away, and he meets Shimi ben Gera. Shimi ben Gera is somebody from the house of Shaul. And he comes out and he says to King David, Tsei Tsei Ish Hadamim V'Ish HaBlial. He calls to David and he said, look, here comes David, the man of blood, the disgusting man. Heshiv Alecha Hashem Kol Dmei Beit Shaul. May God revenge all of the house of Shaul. Now, without reading this story, you would say, what is Shimi referring to? King David had nothing to do with the death of Shaul. He had nothing to do with it. As a matter of fact, no, he kept Shaul alive. What would he be referring to? But if we understand that perhaps this story happened before, so when Shimi ben Gera comes out and he says to him, you have the blood of Shaul's house on your hands, it's very much possible that he is blaming King David for the death of these children. Okay, so that is the understanding of when the chapter happened. What does the chapter teach us? The chapter teaches us, one hand, first of all, I think, is the strength of Ritzpah. I think that comes out clearly from our reading of the chapter, and the influence that she has on preventing civil war, on accepting God's decree, and preventing the Chil Hashem that was done. She is able to counterbalance that, and I think it is she who brings about the Kiddush Hashem, and that is where God is willing to give the reign to them.